You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about traitors. Do we have a traitor problem in Canada?
All democracies have traitor problems from time to time.
The government's final report into foreign interference comes out tomorrow. Will it tell us that this democracy has a traitor problem? Wait for that.
Let's talk about the top three traitors in Canada. Coming in at number three, Robert Fife, journalist from the Globe and Mail. Number two would be the CSIS leaker. And the number one traitor in Canada would be Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre.
Everyone's screaming, call an election. We need an election. They still haven't named the traitors sitting in Parliament now. And we're supposed to call an election and re-elect these people? Name all of them, or all 338 are assumed to be traitors and ineligible to be re-elected.
All of Canada and Alberta needs to start holding Danielle Smith Trump the traitor accountable, because she has to be one of the most disgusting, awful, degenerate human beings I have ever met in my entire life.
So when did all that begin to happen? Doesn't even sound right to me. Canadian traitor. Like, we don't pledge allegiance to a flag here. We don't hiss and boo in history class over stories of Benedict Arnold. I mean, the whole notion of betraying Canada just feels weird. The only traitor to Canada who I learned about in high school was Louis Riel. And the lesson there was that he was not a traitor, and that Canada was at fault for hanging him. At first, it seemed like a bunch of ignorant hooligans glomming on to U.S. rhetoric, amping things up in a very silly and fairly disturbing way, mostly against Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Trudeau is treasonous. Hang Trudeau. That sort of thing, you will remember. But it would be wrong to describe the Canadian hunt for traitors as purely an online dummies and conspiracy theory idiot sort of a thing. Supposedly serious people have been getting in on the act.
This is about as serious as it gets that we have members of Parliament working for hostile foreign states.
This places a cloud of suspicion over every single member of the House.
Han Dong allegedly communicated with the Chinese consulate in Toronto, told the consul general that releasing the two Michaels would have helped the Conservatives.
Media reports today have attacked my reputation and call into questions my loyalty to Canada. What has been reported is false.
There are a number of MPs who have knowingly provided help to foreign governments, some to the detriment of Canada and Canadians.
We've recently seen that RT is currently funding bloggers and other YouTube personalities of the right, such as Jordan Peterson, in order to amplify messages that are destabilizing democracies.
That last one there was a translation of Justin Trudeau himself accusing Jordan Peterson of being Russian-funded. I guess all of this started back in February of 2023 when Global News ran a story by reporter Sam Cooper based on leaks from his sources within CSIS, our spy agency. Those sources alleged that Liberal Member of Parliament Han Dong had secretly advised a Chinese diplomat about delaying the release of the two Michaels, those Canadians who were being held by Beijing at the time, essentially as political prisoners. Han Dong, of course, vociferously denied those allegations, still suing Global News and Sam Cooper over those allegations. But nevertheless, the Liberal Party pushed him out while he was left to sort through the allegations. And ever since then, it's just been a steady drip, drip, drip of partial revelations about foreign interference. Keeps coming. We've learned of warnings sent to Ottawa about compromised MPs that were given by CSIS but ignored, stretching back to 2019. We've heard about meddling from foreign states within Canada's internal party processes through which candidates are selected. We have heard about MPs being used as dupes and other MPs willingly or wittingly duping themselves, allegedly cooperating with the governments of India and China in their foreign interference programs. We have been told that there may be traitors in all of the federal parties. We were assured that a special rapporteur would clear it all up, and then we learned that the special rapporteur himself had credibility complications. And so a judge, Justice Marie-Josée Hogue, would step in instead to give us real answers. We have had Pierre Poilievre refusing to get the security clearance that he would need to read the intelligence documents that would tell him if he had traitors in his own caucus. Meanwhile, there have been shocking revelations about a different kind of foreign interference. Our Prime Minister himself accused India of sending assassins to do murder right here in Canada. It's been a wild ride. But what has it all amounted to? Not one Canadian politician has been charged with anything related to treason. Now, is that because we don't actually have a traitor problem in Canada? Or is it because we don't have the mechanisms or the political will needed to bring these people to justice and to provide the public with solid answers and clarity about this? And maybe we lack that political will on purpose because some of the allegedly compromised politicians are members of the current and outgoing administration. So I don't know, maybe this surge of finger-pointing accusation and counter-accusation. And then it boils over into the popular culture, and now you got people calling reality TV personality Kevin O'Leary a Canadian traitor. Maybe this is just what we get when we have been inhaling the paranoid smoke of foreign interference for years without actually being able to face the fire of it, if any. Well, the Hogue Inquiry's final report on foreign interference will be released tomorrow. Will it put this all to rest? Whether this is all a nothing burger or a something burger, will we know the toppings of that hamburger? Will we finally get some names? Let's ask a professor, a spy shit professor. Wesley Wark is a senior fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation, and he is a fellow at the Balsillie School of International Affairs. He's taught at U of T and McGill. He served on the Prime Minister's Advisory Council on National Security. He provided advice to the Minister of Public Safety on national security legislation and policy. And he is the co-editor of the book Secret Intelligence, A Reader. And he joins me in a minute from Ottawa. Wait for it. Hello, Professor Wark.
Morning. Hello, Jesse. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Do we have a traitor problem in Canada?
All democracies have traitor problems from time to time. And I suppose we should begin by deciding what we mean by traitor. And when I say all democracies, really what I'm referring to is democratic states that need to protect their national security and for that reason run intelligence enterprises of various kinds that hold valuable secrets. And into those intelligence enterprises from time to time come what we would call traitors, double agents, moles, people who basically betray important secrets to a foreign adversary, usually a nation state. Sometimes it can be an organized crime group. For various motivations, sometimes for money, sometimes for rather mysterious motivations beyond money. But it's that it's that giving away of selling, leaking secrets. I like to keep the idea of treason in its kind of traditional box, that is giving away state secrets when you have no authority to do that, and that usually comes out of the world of intelligence.
This is a very measured and academic response. It contrasts with what I read from you in the Toronto Star. The headline is, Canadian politicians who commit treason should go to jail. Maybe that's just an obviosity, that if you commit treason, you should go to jail, but it suggests to me that we do have a traitor problem in Canada. The anonymization and the generalization of details has made this a very frustrating story to cover and to follow. I think the Canadians can be forgiven for not even knowing what the heck this is actually about.
What the heck is this all about? It's a perfectly good question, and it's very hard to get to the bottom of. Even with all of the testimony that we've heard through the public inquiry into foreign interference, still very difficult to know the central question, which is, how significant is this and what was really going on? I'm anxiously waiting to see what Justice Hogue will say on that critical point. What does this all mean? How much foreign interference impacting on the behavior of Parliament has there actually been? Should Canadians be worried, or should they have renewed confidence in the, you know, the basic solidity of our democratic institutions and processes? The one thing that she has said already in the initial report is, look, the 2019 and 2021 federal elections were not impacted in any significant way by foreign interference. Canadians should have confidence in the outcome of those elections. But there's more to be said about the details, and in particular about this pretty stunning report that came out from the National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians. I think there will be challenges in getting to the bottom of it, not least the challenge being how much can she say in public on the basis of secret intelligence records. My hope is that when the public inquiry into foreign interference produces its final report, that it will be able to really provide a more conclusive picture of the extent to which any parliamentarians, past or present, have engaged in genuine foreign interference activities on the part of a foreign state. The one thing I think we can be clear about, and she said this herself, she has no intention and no authority to name names in any of these cases. She would, you know, believes that that would be totally inappropriate, and I totally agree with her on that. But there's a lot more substance that could be brought to this story.
Why shouldn't she name names if her inquiry reveals that people who have been elected to represent Canadians have been selling us out and helping foreign countries that do not necessarily have our interests at heart and in fact might be working to destabilize us or interfere with our democratic processes? And here we are contemplating which of these people we should run again for office or we should vote for again. Why shouldn't we know their names?
Well, there's a lot of ifs in that question, isn't there, Jesse? First of all, a public inquiry is not a court of law. People who might be named in a public inquiry would have no legal recourse, as you would in a court of law, to defend their reputation. So it would be, in that sense, completely unfair. I think undemocratic. It would amount to a witch hunt, and it would run as a witch hunt. We also have to understand that these allegations emerge out of intelligence records, which the public themselves will never see. We'll have no capacity to really understand those intelligence records, what they say, they don't say, how well corroborated they are, and so forth. We're going to have to rely on Justice Hogue to provide us with a picture of that in general terms. But there'd be no way for the public to say, well, okay, we've named X, Y, and Z as witting accomplices. It's based on intelligence. You know, what do we make of all that? I have said over and over again, I think this is completely undemocratic as a practice, were we to name names. And I think it reminds me very strongly of the McCarthyite period.
But the witch hunt is already well underway. We have...
Well, it's not underway. Come on. I mean, like, witch hunt against who? I mean, there have been various kinds of allegations about unnamed individuals. In the course of, you know, 16 months of a public inquiry, There has been a lot of attention paid to the nomination contest. In 2019, one nomination contest across the land in one federal election with regard to Han Dong, without any conclusions reached about the extent to which Mr. Dong may or may not have known that there was any involvement by officials or proxies of the People's Republic of China in trying to steer that nomination contest in any way, shape, or form. To be honest, I don't think there's anything very solid there that would impel us to go to extraordinary lengths to pillory people in the public square.
Well, when I say that the witch hunt is well underway, what I am referring to is that in the absence of names, accusations flying back and forth that there's very serious stuff in these secret documents that the public can't be trusted with, but you can't know who. Well, in that ambiguity is space for NDP Member of Parliament Peter Julian to suggest publicly that Pierre Poilievre is only leader of the Conservative Party of Canada because foreign interference put him there. There's even space for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to say that Jordan Peterson is funded by Russia and be protected by parliamentary privilege and not have to prove that in any way. We have Jagmeet Singh saying that he's even more alarmed about foreign interference after reading the unredacted intelligence report. And it opens the door for just like rampant speculation as to who is compromised and which party is more compromised and who got put into office unfairly. I take your point very well that that this is not a legal process. So to put somebody's name out is irresponsible if they don't have the opportunity to defend themselves. But I guess what I want to know is if in fact, and it seems like there's good reason to believe that there has been treason, by what mechanism will the public ever know? Or is that not important?
That's a bit of a leading question.
Yes, I specialize in those. Yeah, I want to know. I want to lead you to that. Is there any way that we're going to find out?
Yeah, so if treason had been committed, how would we find out? We'd find out through a trial. And if a prosecution and a treasonable case is not pursued, that's a different issue. That raises the question, well, you know, why not? I think we have to step back and take a breath here and ask ourselves, what actually have we learned about foreign interference and its impact? And there's a huge difference between learning about foreign interference attempts and thinking about impacts. And I think Canadians have to appreciate the distinction between those things and perhaps be unsurprised that some foreign states from time to time will try to conduct foreign interference campaigns, but at the same time, it's important to take the measure of the impact of those and ask ourselves, well, were they successful? You know, what was the outcome? So at the end of the day, Jesse, what I would really like to have as a menu for Canadians is a fact-based, authoritative account of foreign interference from Justice Hoge and an appreciation that we got hold of the wrong end of the stick. So what am I talking about here? When we are concerned with foreign interference, shaped by leaks, shaped by the political process, has been focused on interference in elections and democratic processes.
Mm-hmm.
That is the least of the concerns that foreign interference poses. What are the real concerns? And they've been long understood. The real concerns are foreign interference manifests itself most dangerously in two shapes and forms.
Let me get this straight. You think that in all of this talk about foreign interference, we've been missing the two main points. So what are these two main points that we've missed?
One is espionage, targeting governments, targeting especially these days the private sector, and it's very aggressive. It's conducted by the same states that are trying to meddle in democratic institutions and processes. How much has been said about the threat of foreign interference as espionage in all of this debate since the fall of 2022, nothing. Like, this is a distinctly Canadian problem. The second thing is, and there's been, you know, much more attention to this, but it's not really central to the remit of the public inquiry, is that foreign interference, in addition to the espionage threat, takes its most menacing form in terms of transnational repression, the way in which foreign states try to meddle in and with diaspora communities in countries like Canada to either try and encourage diaspora communities to take on board a view of politics that that suits a foreign state, or, you know, through various means, often very malicious, tries to suppress dissent altogether. Espionage, transnational repression, those are the threats. We have been chasing threats to democratic institutions and processes in a way that I think has taken our eyes off the ball.
That's interesting. And we have been hearing from these diaspora communities that they have been harassed and threatened, and that Beijing has set up impromptu, like, secret police stations and shopping malls, threatening people's families back home, trading favors with the Indian consulate to espionage in exchange for a visa. All of this is coming to light. How separable this is from interference with our democratic institutions, again, is in that haze. If we can trust people to have the facts, they can make up their own minds about this. But a lot of the facts, I mean, from a journalistic point of view, is the who, what, when, where, and how, and that's not going to be in the report. So yes, it does fall to the media, not just to analyze the report, but to do our own digging. And you're quite right that a lot of this began with leaks to the press, not in the opinion columns, but Fife and Chase and Sam Cooper reporting what leakers from CSIS told them. How would the public ever know? And you said, well, if in fact an MP has done this, if it's committed treason, they should be put on trial. I have a follow-up question for you on that in a second, but there's another way that the public knows, which is it's possible that the media does more than just analyze a report from an inquiry. We actually can go investigate and find things out for ourselves, and sometimes it's very controversial when we do it.
But, Jesse, you can't. Let's be honest about that. You can't.
What do you mean you can't? Of course you can. Why can't the media investigate treason?
I mean, we don't have the kind of environment, governmental environment, media environment, that would make that possible. It would be possible in some other states. It's not possible here.
Because of failures of our media?
Well, I'm not calling them failures. I'm talking about something else, which is that the media community, by and large, doesn't understand how intelligence works or the institutions of intelligence. The media has no access to widespread intelligence secrets. We don't really have a culture of leaking on a widespread scale, as you would have in the United States, for example. You don't have media columnists who really understand that inside world at all. There is a huge, huge wall that cannot be jumped over between the media and the secret world. And that is a reality in Canada. I'm not saying it's a good reality. I find it a regretful reality, but it's a reality. I appreciate the sentiment that the media could dig and find, but I don't think it's a reality. And what we would get would be variations on the kinds of leaks that we've seen so far, and the kinds of unsubstantiated, often, stories that have resulted from those leaks.
It's all well and good to call the news stories unsubstantiated. I've heard a lot of criticism. I'm not sure if you're criticizing Sam Cooper or the Globe and Mail for their follow-up stories that were relying on these CSIS sources based on them being not sufficiently substantiated. I've certainly heard that criticism. That's all well and good, but I've also heard from the special rapporteur himself that if not for these media reports, we wouldn't have the special rapporteur or the public inquiry that's been called when the special rapporteur acknowledged that he was not the right guy for the job. We wouldn't be looking at this at all if not for the media. So in your view, what is the appropriate role? We don't have a culture of leaking. Okay, maybe we could work on that. But what is the appropriate role for the media? What is the appropriate role for the media this week when the report comes out?
The final report of the public inquiry, you know, let's say it's something like the initial report. It's 150 pages. It's going to be pretty dense. Very few Canadians will read it. And so it's up to the media to take an appropriate position on what the report actually says. You know, do their job, which I hope they'll do. And it's through the media that the public will come to some view of what the public inquiry says. The public inquiry will make recommendations. That's what public inquiries do. I think Canadians have to understand that recommendations are recommendations, and whatever recommendations Justice Hogue makes will have no impact on the next election. They won't have time to be digested and implemented, even if a government of the day decides they're worth implementing. So, you know, these recommendations are going to be out there for a while, shaping the public discourse into the next government, and that's probably a good thing.
I mean, Professor, that's not the most satisfying answer. You'll understand that, you know, in our quest for answers and accountability, you know, you say we're not going to get it from the media, and we to return instead to Justice Hogue. She's going to give us a report. It won't have names in it. It'll have suggestions and recommendations, and the government of the day won't have time to digest or implement them. But maybe the suggestions will shape the discourse. I mean, if the real bottom line here about what should happen if somebody, specifically a politician, commits treason, is that they should go to jail for it, which is what your Toronto Star article said, and we have courts here to deal with this, well, have they? I mean, has that actually happened? Like, I don't know the answer to this question. Since Louis Riel, has a Canadian politician been convicted by the courts of treason?
Not really. And when I say that, not really, you'd say, well, it's proof that the courts can't deal with it. It may be proof that there hasn't been a lot of it. I mean, the most famous case in which a member of parliament was convicted of breaching the Official Secrets Act went back to the Gouchenko affair. And the conviction of a Montreal MP, who was a Communist Party member, the only Communist Party member in the House of Commons at the time, who was part of the spy ring working for the Soviets that Gouchenko uncovered, and he went to jail. After that, we've certainly had cases of treason. And it's certainly true in the past, just to speak to your point, it's true in the past that governments are often extremely reluctant to bring these cases into court because it exposes secrets and it's embarrassing. But recently we've had two landmark cases where treason has been charged and prosecuted, treason under the Security of Information Act. This is the Delisle spy case. It goes back to the early 2010s, who provided a lot of intelligence to the Russians over about a five-year period. And then more recently, the case of an RCMP senior official, civilian, who was in charge of intelligence coming in and out of the RCMP named Cameron Ordis.
After deliberating for 2 days, a jury convicted Cameron Ordis of leaking top secret information. The former director general of the RCMP's National Intelligence Coordination Center was the first person to be tried under Canada's Security of Information Act. Both the prosecution and defense had to watch what they said in court.
It's been very tricky.
Why?
Well, because of the national security issues.
So it can be done. And we have updated legislation to deal with it. And we have even newer legislation as a result of this past summer and the passage of something called Bill C-70, which would criminalize various forms of foreign interference. So the law is there. Whether the prosecutorial will is there, whether the evidence can ever be properly accumulated, stand up to scrutiny and the usual process in court. The other point I would make is that while it's understandable, I think it'd be entirely wrong for Canadians to think we are somehow uniquely vulnerable and susceptible to foreign interference. We're just like all the other democracies out there that are vulnerable and susceptible. You know, we are targets because we're democracies. We may be doing a less than stellar job in meeting those threats. There are ways that we can improve defenses against those threats. But democracies are always going to be vulnerable to foreign interference, and Canada is nothing special, I think, in that regard. We're just like everybody else.
Perhaps you're right, and we're no different than anyone else, any other nation. Or maybe they've gotten to you too, Professor Work.
They haven't, I promise.
I mean, I do have to ask, though, like, you know, if Canada saw fit to hang Louis Riel, which was a stain on our history and a terrible injustice, but we did it. If we hung Louis Riel, then surely we can hang Kevin O'Leary. You don't have to answer. Professor Work, this has been really interesting. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks, Jesse.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you liked it. You can email me about anything you heard today at jesse@canadaland.com. I'm on Blue Sky. Look me up there. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Sam Connert fact-checked today's episode. Max Collins is Canada Land's director of audio. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now.